This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Today, through Labor Day, we'll hear from soul singers, songwriters, session musicians, and producers. We start with the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin.
I am getting the spirit in the dark. I'm getting the spirit in the dark. People moving, falling, we're grooving. Just getting a spirit in the dark. Tell me, sister, how do you feel? Tell me, my brother, how do you feel? If you feel like dancing, get up and let's start dancing. Start getting the spirit.
Start getting the spirit
in the dark.
You can always hear the sounds of the church in Aretha Franklin's music. She got her start singing in the Detroit church, where her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, was the pastor. When she was 14, she left school and went on the road with her father. 4 years later, she moved to New York, where she was signed by Columbia Records. But after 9 albums, she still hadn't established a strong identity. That changed when she moved to Atlantic Records and made such soul classics as Respect, I Never Loved a Man, Do Right Woman, A Natural Woman, and Think. In the book Sweet Soul Music, Peter Guralnick writes, there has been no pop singer more inspired than Aretha when it comes to sheer vocal artistry. Aretha Franklin seldom gives interviews. I spoke with her last year after the publication of her autobiography, which was written with David Ritz. I'd like to play a recording that was made of you at the age of 14, singing in the church in which your father was pastor, the New Bethel Church in Detroit.
Yes, New Bethel Baptist Church.
And this is a recording of Precious Lord. The version we're going to hear was made in 1956. This is the young 14-year-old Aretha Franklin.
When my way
That's the young Aretha Franklin. Let's talk a little bit about the influences on you during your formative years. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. He was one of the mm-hmm. most popular preachers of his generation. He was nationally known through his tours and through, mm-hmm. I think, radio broadcasts as well as recordings. You say in the book that church nurses carried smelling salts to revive worshipers who were overcome to mm-hmm. the point of fainting by the Spirit or by your mm-hmm. father's sermons. Mm-hmm. What was mm-hmm. it like for you to watch your father speak and people fainting in church?
Well, it was tremendous. I love going to church. I enjoyed being a part of the choir and just doing things in and around the church. But as a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You toured with your father through mm-hmm. churches through the Deep South, and I'm wondering what it was like for you during the days of mm-hmm. segregation to tour through mm-hmm. the Deep South. You know, how that compared to what you were used to in Detroit. Mm-hmm.
Well, it certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit, but on the other hand, it was not that bad. We didn't have extreme experiences of any kind, but there were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms, and we got information that Gulf... you could use the bathrooms there if you, and we didn't buy gas where we could not use the restrooms. So we went to golf a lot, I must tell you.
You say about your father, he was a minister, he was also a man, and that some mm-hmm. women pursued him aggressively night and day.
Mm-hmm. They did.
So he wasn't uncomfortable with that.
I have no idea. I never discussed it with him, and he never discussed that sort of thing with his children. But as children, we could certainly see that women were kind of aggressively taking off behind him. He was single at the time, and sometimes you might see it with a lady sitting on the front row, a little high, skirts a little high, a little short, things like that, or in other ways that we're all familiar with. You know when women are interested.
Mm-hmm. I thought I'd play an excerpt from what is perhaps his most famous recorded sermon, The Eagle Stirreth. Mm-hmm. Since we'll only be hearing an excerpt just to get a sense of his style of preaching, can you tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about what the sermon was actually about?
Having to do, as I equate it, to life, to children, to the parental function in the raising of one's children, and in certain other ways, there are parallels to your personal life.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. Let's hear an excerpt of a sermon preached by her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
Most of us forget it.
Yeah, right.
It is said that there was a man who had a poultry farm.
Yeah.
And that he raised chickens for the market.
Yes.
And one day in one of his broods, he discovered a strange-looking bird.
Yes.
That was very much unlike the other chickens on the yard.
Yes.
And the man didn't pay too much attention, but he noticed as time went on that this strange-looking bird
yes.
was unusual.
Yes.
He outgrew the other little chicken.
Yes.
Oh, Lord. And then one day a man who knew eagles when he saw it came along and saw that little eagle walking in the yard. And he said to his friend, "Do you know that you have an eagle here? What you ought to do is build a cage."
Yes,
after a while, when he's a little older, he's going to get tired of the ground.
Yes,
yes he will. Yes. He's going to rise up on the pinion of his wings. Yes. Yes. One of these days, one of these days,
yes.
My soul
yes.
is an eagle
yes.
in the cage that the Lord
yes.
had made for me.
Yes.
My soul
yes.
my soul
yes.
is caged. body. Yes, it is. And one of these days, the man who made the cage, he'll open the door. See me take the wings of my soul. Yeah, 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 yeah. What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Did you hear me say? Yeah, I'll fly away and be at rest.
That's Aretha Franklin's late father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. Could you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
The neighborhood that I grew up in was the north end of Detroit, and we stayed on Boston Boulevard just off of Oakland. And in that particular neighborhood were some people that we all know. Smokey Robinson lived just a block from me. Anna Ross lived a few doors from Smokey. Most of the Miracles stayed on the North End. It was pretty much a middle to upper class neighborhood on the North End of Detroit.
Growing up in the same neighborhood with Diana Ross and Smokey Robinson, were you aware of each other as performers? And did you expect did they expect that you would go on to be such famous people?
We were aware of each other. Smokey and my brother and my family have always been best friends from small children on until today.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Aretha Franklin. Now, you were friends with Sam Cooke, the great gospel singer turned soul singer. How did you meet?
Sam and I met at a Sunday evening program that we had at our church back in the early 50s. And I was sitting there waiting for the program to start after church. And I just happened to look back over my shoulder, and I saw this group of people coming down the aisle. And, oh, my God, the man that was leading them, Sam, and his brother L.C., and these guys were really super sharp. They had on beautiful blue and navy blue and brown trench coats. And I had never seen anyone quite as attractive, not a male as attractive as Sam was. And so prior to the program, my soul was kind of being stirred in another way.
Well, now, he crossed over from gospel to pop before you did. What impact did it have on you when you heard him having a hit pop song on the radio?
What impact did it have on me when Sam crossed over? We were going down the highway. We were somewhere in the South. And my sister and I and the driver and maybe one or two other people in the car, we knew that he had left the gospel field. And, of course, I was rather sad about that. But as we were driving, we knew that he had recorded. And just out of the dark came this fabulous voice. And it was Sam, and it was his first record. And he was singing "You Send Me." And there was just pandemonium in the car. My sister and I just had a fit. We really had to pull over and stop the car and settle down. Oh, my God, it's Sam. It's Sam. It's his record. You know, it was like that. You send me. It's his record, you know. And there was just so much excitement in the car. The driver really had to pull over.
So did that make you think, maybe I should consider making pop records?
Well, I don't know at the time. I don't think that was my feeling, and it wasn't to begin with. But as time went on and I just began to listen to more and more of his recordings, and I loved them the way they were produced, the melodies, the background singers. As time went on, I began to think about the broader view I was interested in changing fields as well, but I was not as confident, I guess, as Sam was to begin with. And finally, I said, well, if Sam made it, maybe I could too. And I was willing to give it a try.
Well, you were signed at Columbia by John Hammond, who had earlier mm-hmm. signed Count Basie and later signed Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen.
Uh-huh.
Well, I want to play the first track that you recorded with John Hammond, and it's mm-hmm. Today I Sing the Blues.
Okay.
Without a word of warning, the blues walked in this morning and circled around my lonely room. I didn't know why I had that sad and lonely feeling until my baby called and said, we're through. Ooh. Oh, yesterday, this time I sang a love song. But today, I'm singing the blues. It strikes me kind of funny how love can be this way. But I'm alone again today. And it strikes me kind of funny how fate can be unfair. Must be written for me that I should be the one to always lose. For yesterday, yesterday this time I sing a love song.
That's Aretha Franklin from the early part of her pop recording career. Now, you were playing a lot of clubs during those early years, and a mm-hmm. lot of those clubs were jazz clubs, and the people who you shared a bill with included John Coltrane and Charles Mingus. Mm-hmm. Was this mm-hmm. a new kind of music for you?
Not exactly a new kind of music. As a very small girl, I listened to Charlie Parker and loved him. And Max Roach and people like that. I had not been in the jazz environment, having been brought up in the church. But once I got to New York and I was signed to perform at the Village Gate and the Vanguard and clubs like that. And these, the Vanguard was one of the most elite, if not the most elite jazz club out there. Then I began to meet jazz musicians and to become more familiar with that environment and comfortable with it.
What was different about the jazz environment? What were some of the things you hadn't been exposed to before?
Well, I certainly had not been exposed to Charlie Mingus reaching over, and I think he slapped the pianist that one night.
Right. Sounds like Mingus.
Sitting in the audience then, this was at the Village Gate, and he kept right on playing. You know, nobody missed a beat.
Aretha Franklin recorded last year after the publication of her autobiography. We'll hear more from her in the second half of the show as Soul Music Week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Soul Music Week on Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews with soul singers, songwriters, session musicians, and producers. Let's get back to our interview with Aretha Franklin, recorded last year. She started her recording career at Columbia Records, but she didn't really establish herself as a soul singer until producer Jerry Wexler brought her to Atlantic Records. Your sound really changed at Atlantic, and so did your material. Mm-hmm. Did he set you down before you started recording and say, this is what I see for you, this is what I hear?
Yes, he did. Actually, where I had been in the booth most of the time at Columbia, and not at the piano, Jerry asked me to sit down and accompany myself. And that is where my career really took a drastic 160-degree turnaround. I just accompany myself in a very different way than most other pianists do. And I think that that was the factor that made the difference.
For your first Atlantic recording session, the producer Jerry Wexler took you down to a studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that was famous for its great session men, which included Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham. And the first song that you recorded there was I Never Loved a Man. Now, Spooner Oldham tells the story that when he heard you sit down at the piano and play your first chord, he thought, wow, that's really great. And that he's a pianist, that he should let you play piano while he moved over to electric piano playing behind you. Mm-hmm. What'd you think of that arrangement? Were you pleased that he agreed that you should be the one at the piano?
I remember that particular session. It was the very first session, so naturally, yes, I remember it. And we really were kind of struggling at that point to get to the music. It just wasn't quite coming off, although we had dynamite players. We had the Muscle Shoals section, and they were really very, very hot, cutting a lot of good greasy stuff, or what you would call greasy in that day. But we weren't getting to the music in the way that we should have. It just wasn't coming off. And finally, someone said, Aretha, why don't you sit down and play? And I did. And it just happened. It all just happened. We arrived, and we arrived very quickly.
Well, Peter Guralnick, the music critic, describes this recording, I Never Loved a Man, as one of the most momentous takes in the history of rhythm and blues, in fact, in the history of American vernacular music. Let's hear it. This is my guest, Aretha Franklin. That's Aretha Franklin, her first recording for Atlantic Records. Now, your second single was Respect, which is, I believe, mm-hmm. your still most requested song. How did you end up singing this Otis Redding song?
Well, I heard Mr. Redding's version of it. I just loved it. And I decided that I wanted to record it. And my sister Carolyn and I got together. I was living in a small apartment on the west side of Detroit. And piano by the window, watching the cars go by. And we came up with that infamous line, the sock it to me line. It was a cliche of the day. Actually, we didn't just come up with it. It really was cliche. And some of the girls were saying that to the fellas, like, sock it to me in this way or sock it to me in that way. Nothing sexual, and it's not sexual. It was non-sexual, just a cliche line. But anyway, Laugh In picked it up, and it just kind of perpetuated itself and went on from there.
What did this song mean to you when you sang it? I mean, really, part of the backdrop of the song, it was a hit during the Civil Rights Movement. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, Respect had a lot of meanings in this song for your listeners. One was, you know, just the respect you wanted from a man in a relationship. But it also mm-hmm. had, I think, a larger resonance with the Civil Rights Movement, you know, a kind of larger social, cultural sense of respect.
Yes, in later times it was picked up as a battle cry by the Civil Rights Movement. But when I recorded it, it was pretty much a male-female kind mm-hmm. of thing. And more in a general sense from person to person.
Well, let's hear Aretha Franklin singing Respect. Our interview with Aretha Franklin was recorded last year. This is Fresh Air.